Hello, everybody. Paul Boyer here for Mad Money Machine Show 172 for Tuesday, January 5th, 2010, the year we make contact.
Step outside, take a look at the stars. Catch a glimpse of the way things are. Making contact. Making contact. Making contact.
That's Bruce Coburn from his 1984 album Stealing Fire, Making Contact. Also features the songs Lovers in a Dangerous Time and If I Had a Rocket Launcher, which you can also find out at grooveshark.com. Go to grooveshark.com and type in those titles. And the album also features this exotic song called Maybe the Poet. Yeah, I couldn't find that track out at grooveshark.com, so I guess you'll have to go out and actually buy the song. Maybe the Poet by Bruce Coburn from his Stealing Fire album. All right, let's get on with the investing talk in 2010, the year we make contact. Oh, let's see. So it's the lost decade. According to IFA.com, according to their risk and return calculator, for a large cap stock fund, if you put your money in it on January 1st, 2000, let's say you put a dollar in the large cap stock market, January 1st, 2000, 10 years ago, your dollar would be worth, today, 89 cents. Oh, man. Oh, my goodness. It's the first decade, apparently, even-numbered. What I mean to say is it's the first 10 years of the same numerical digit in the 10 spot. The 0, the 90s, the 80s, the 70s, the 60s, and so forth. That stocks haven't made you money. At least large cap stocks. And so, it reminds us of the Japan lost decade in which stocks didn't make money in the Japanese stock market. I wonder how the next 10 years will turn out. The year of the, what, the tens, the teens, 20-teens, and how we will do in the stock market in the next 10 years. It doesn't seem like we're out of the woods yet with the economy. It doesn't seem like we're out of the woods yet with the supply of dollars. And, of course, the supply of dollars is a major factor in the world economy and how asset prices will perform. I've talked a little bit more about inflation and how if there are more dollars, then it takes more dollars to buy things, buy assets. Well, why wouldn't it take more money to buy stocks as well? And more money to buy bonds. We shall see. Before I get it too deep into the investing world, just talk a little bit about the past holiday season. We saw some movies. We did see Avatar in 3D. We saw The Blind Side with Sandra Bullock being the oh-so-good mother. We saw 2012. I saw the movie Collapse. I think I talked about that in the last show. Saw Food, Inc. We've been watching Shark Tank on ABC. And this is a show, if you haven't seen it, where there are, what, 5 self-made entrepreneurs with lots of money who are looking for startup investments. And so people come on the show pitching their ideas and then ask for some money and typically a percent stake in the company, some equity in the company. And the sharks then negotiate on typically wanting more equity in the company or ownership outright of the company in exchange for the investment. And one of the guys that came on was a guy that had a website that buys gift cards. You know how at Christmas time you get gift cards for stores that you really don't care to go to? So what you do with your gift card then is you send it into this guy through at his website, at least this is his pitch, he'll give you 60 cents on the dollar for the gift card. So if you had a $100 gift card, he'll give you 60 bucks for it. Then he turns around and sells it to somebody else for, say, $80, and he pockets the difference, the $20 spread in the ask and bid price, I guess, bid and ask price. Well, I don't know that the sharks went for that business, but it got me thinking about this whole gift card industry. You know, I go into grocery stores now, and there's a whole rack where they sell gift cards to all these different restaurants and other kinds of stores and places, including their own grocery store gift cards. And I wonder if someone will open an entire store someday, you know, like a small storefront in a mall or something, where all they do is sell gift cards. You know, the entire walls are just filled with gift cards. It would be the gift card store. And then taking that one step further, I wonder if the gift card store will sell gift cards to itself so that you could give someone a gift card to the gift card store so that they could go in and exchange that then for a gift card. That's how, that's the financial society that we're in. We talk about the financial innovations. We talk about derivatives. Well, that's a kind of a derivative, isn't it, on cash? It's two layers removed from cash. And that's why the world is as messed up as it is, I guess. Well, I have posted out at madmoneymachine.com some of the results for lazy portfolios for the past 3 years. And you know how we've kept track of some professional lazy portfolios over the past to try to see, you know, which mix of asset classes might serve us well. Which one would have the highest return versus the lowest risk, you know, if you plot that on a chart, return on the y-axis going up and risk going across from zero on the left all the way high to the right, you want to be top left. You want to have high returns for low risk. So which portfolio would do the best there? And so this has been a particularly strange period for equity portfolios, I guess, making most of them negative for the past 3 years. Take, for example, the one that I talked about a lot on Mad Money Machine in the early days, medium days, the IFA Index Portfolio 100 Bright Red. This past year did well, up 33.4%, according to the data on their website. But for the past 3 years, the portfolio was down 18.7% using their calculator. Well, all of the portfolios, except for four, are negative for 3 years. In number fourth spot is Scott Burns' couch potato portfolio with 1.3% gain over 3 years. And if I remember this portfolio correctly, let me just look it up for you right now. I'm going to go into the Mad Money Machine website and click on the link there for lazy portfolios. And you can click then on the link that gets you to the professional portfolios and the description of each portfolio. And this one turns out to be portfolio number 15. It's Scott Burns' couch potato portfolio. And it's the dumb, simple portfolio. You put half in the entire stock market and half into inflation-protected securities. And so, whereas the stock market itself didn't do all well in the past 3 years, the inflation-protected securities gave the portfolio a little bit of gain and got its head just above water. Coming in at number three, the Bogle Tax Sheltered Accounts portfolio. John Bogle, in an article that Jason Zweig wrote several years ago, had two portfolios, one from John Bogle to use in tax-sheltered accounts, and another one from William Bernstein to use intaxable accounts. And I think I have that in the list too. But the Bogle tax sheltered portfolio came in at number three. The performance of that for the 3 years was up 2.7%. That portfolio, lost it here in the list. Let me go down. Portfolio number 27 in my list. He has 40% in the total stock market, the U.S. stock market, 30% in intermediate term U.S. treasuries, 10% in Vanguard total international stock market, then 10% in Vanguard inflation protected securities, and the final 10% in PIMCO foreign bonds, rounding out the 100%. In the number two spot, the Harry Brown permanent portfolio. And the only reason that's in number two is because the number one position is the permanent portfolio fund, which I added newly into the list just before publishing the results. I wanted to compare how the mutual fund that tracks Harry Brown permanent portfolio itself did. Now, the permanent portfolio mutual fund, PRPFX, deviates a little bit from the pure Harry Brown permanent portfolio approach, where he has 25% in each of four various asset classes. I think the permanent portfolio mutual fund also includes things like silver, Swiss francs, some of the other short-term treasuries instead of cash and things like that. So permanent portfolio mutual fund was the winner here by about 1.6% over the Harry Brown permanent portfolio. The total numbers here for 3 years, the gain in the Harry Brown permanent portfolio up 20.1%. This is total, not annualized. And the permanent portfolio fund, of course, up 21.7% in those 3 years. And why did these two portfolios beat everything else? Well, because they had a quarter at least of their assets in precious metals, in gold or in silver, which have done well recently. And, future results may vary in these portfolios, in all portfolios. Well, just looking at this list of portfolio results by no means gives you a way to pick one to invest in. You know, you can't just look at this and say, all right, I should pick the top performer and that's the way I want to invest. No, better is to understand what is the actual risk in each of these portfolios. And that brings me to the other posting I put out at MadmanMachine.com website, risk versus return chart of 2007 through 2009. I took some of the select portfolios, the Harry Brown permanent portfolio, the Fund Advice Ultimate Buy and Hold portfolio, the Scott Burns Six Ways from Sunday portfolio, which includes, if you remember, six parts equal, one of which is the Energy Fund, Vanguard Energy Fund, and the Vanguard Precious Metals and Mining Fund. That's the Scott Burns Six Ways from Sunday portfolio. William Bernstein's No-Brainer portfolio, Bill Schulte's Coffee House portfolio, Scott Burns's Couch Potato portfolio, the IFA Index Portfolio 100, and David Swinson's Lazy portfolio. It's all these very, very popular portfolios, some of them having books of their own or newspaper articles describing how they are set up and operated. And I've taken their annualized return for the past 3 years, and I've calculated their annualized standard deviation. That's their measurement of risk. And I have to admit that, first of all, my numbers may be wrong because the spreadsheet I'm using, it may have some slight variations in the actual date that it picks stock prices from the Yahoo Finance page and so forth. But I think it gets us in the ballpark, all right? It may not be exactly right, but it gets us in the ballpark. And if you look at that graph, what you'll see is that most of these, well, all of these portfolios, except for one, of course, are negative for those 3 years. They're below the zero return line. And their risk is to the right of the Harry Brown permanent portfolio. And what this is showing us is that the risk of owning a portfolio, equal amounts of stocks, bonds, long-term bonds, cash, and gold, the risk in that portfolio is apparently less for a higher return than other portfolios. Now, one thing I'd like to do is look at this. You know, 3 years is not a good enough, not a long enough snapshot, really, to tell us anything significant of what the possibilities are for a uncertain future. So one of the things I think I'll be doing over the coming weeks is looking at this return versus risk chart for different time periods. I know one thing I've done is gone back and looked at these portfolios from the period 1972 through 1981. That's a decade where the gold window was shut in 1971 and gold was able to float in price, and that's the earliest times we have a floating price for gold. And it was also a time where we had high inflation in the early 80s there, 1980, 81. So it's interesting to look at that portfolio in that high inflation time period. But it would also be interesting to look at this portfolio in the decade of the 90s, you know, from 90 to 99, when we had the great run-up in tech stocks and all of that. What was the risk of the portfolio during that time period? So those are the kinds of things I'll be looking at and reporting to you here on Mad Money Machine. You can keep track of the things of the progress that I'll report, the analysis, out at madmoneymachine.com. And we'll try to figure out the best way to invest. Got a pretty cool board game. It's not a board game. It's a game. Card game, actually. Over the holidays, called Race for the Galaxy. And if you don't play a lot of board games, card games, running out and buying a box with Race for the Galaxy in it and trying to open up and read the instructions might be a bit intimidating for you. If you just like to play dominoes and rummy, you might find the rule book for Race for the Galaxy quite intimidating. I think it goes on for about 12 pages. So you open the box, you know, Christmas morning, you open this thing and you say, hey, let's play a game of Race for the Galaxy. And you sit down and you look at this rule book and say, oh my gosh. So it does take some study. If you've played San Juan, then this game is very close in design to the way San Juan works. If you've played Puerto Rico, San Juan is very close in theme to the way Puerto Rico works. So I guess working backwards, you could imagine a board game made out of Race for the Galaxy that's like Puerto Rico. Wow, A equals B, B equals C, C equals D in this case. So, Race for the Galaxy, it's number 12 out at BoardGameGeek.com. Very complicated game. The cards have a lot of different meanings to them, a lot of different powers, a lot of different attributes. Cards are used in different ways, and it's a pretty good game. Good game. If you're a gamer, I'd say take a look at Race for the Galaxy. Let's pull something out of the Mad Money Machine tool crib. So you're driving down the highway. The red light comes on your dashboard saying you need gasoline. Well, what you need is your iPhone equipped with cheap gas. Just bring up cheap gas on your iPhone. It'll know where you are, and it'll direct you to the closest gas station with the cheapest price. Yep. Just like the online website that helped you locate gas, this is the iPhone application that makes it so much better because you can find where you are and find what the cheapest gas station is nearby. What I find is it seems like every gas station charges basically the same price. But that's our tool in the crib for this week, and like other tools I've given you so far, it's free cheap gas. Things in life are free. You can keep it for the birds and bees. Now give me money. Now give me money, 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 money. That's what I want. That's what I want. Well, our kittens are growing up. Lady Gray, the Russian Blue, is getting real big, and Mojo is kind of a tuxedo cat, maybe they call it, black on top and white on the bottom. About the same age, I'd say within a month, and is a lot smaller than Lady Grey. Lady Grey is, they're both ladies. Mojo, sounding like a male name, is, we call her Moji sometimes. Moji is a lot smaller than Lady Grey, which makes me wonder about humans. Is that the case in humans too? Are there thin humans and thicker humans by nature? I hope so. Well, you go into a store and you buy something and the total comes to $6.18. $6.18. Now, a lot of people just reach into their wallet and pull out a 20 and give it to the clerk there at the counter, ringing it up. But for those of us who are more concerned about the size, the thickness of our wallets, for $6.18, I might pull out a 10, a 1, and if I don't have exactly 18 cents in my pocket, I might pull out a quarter and 3 pennies. And I hand this, you know, this wad full of collection of U.S. currency over to the clerk. And usually what happens is the clerk looks down at this, you know, mess of money, a 10, a 1, a quarter, and 3 pennies. And then looks back at me and kind of squints, and I say, just punch it in. Just punch it into the cash register there. So they do that. You know, instead of then having to reach in and give me a 1 and a 1 and a 1 and a quarter and a quarter and a quarter and a dime and 2 pennies back in change, all they have to do then is reach in and get me a 5 and a dime. It makes the process so much simpler on them. Therefore, I don't like that squinty-eyed look they give me when I give them my money. I haven't talked about it in about a year or so. End the cent. Maybe I should write a book. End the cent. Hasn't been a lot of progress. I guess we've been too preoccupied with the trillions of dollars and not so much the pennies, the one hundredths of dollars. So a trillion is how much money? It's a million million. You think $1 million is a lot of money, right? I mean, if you had $1 million, wouldn't you appreciate having that? Well, a trillion is $1 million. And of course, the U.S. budget deficit they talk about is in the $12 or $14 trillion range. That seems like an awful lot of money. I've been reading Ron Paul's book, End the Fed. It's actually pretty good. There are some things in there that I did not know. I got a copy from the library and enjoy reading that pretty much. One of the things I've seen on blog sites is if your money is in one of the big too big to fail banks, well, go to the website called moveyourmoney.info. Moveyourmoney.info. There's a cute little video out there based on It's a Wonderful Life with Jimmy Stewart, you know, the banker. And what they try to make the case for is if you don't like the way these bankers, these too-big-to-fail banks, are taking advantage of us, the taxpayer, well, move your money. Move it to a smaller community bank. By goodness, they definitely need your money. Of course, I guess the caution there would be make sure you're putting it into a solvent community bank. They'll have a list on their websites of which bank in your neighborhood is the most solvent, and you might consider moving your money from the big ones into your local bank so that they can make local loans to help out your own community. Well, I was talking earlier about the Harry Brown permanent portfolio, and, you know, of course, in that 25% is in gold. I've been thinking about, wow, what if you actually owned 25% of your net worth in gold? And then you had to go sell it, right? I mean, at some point, the whole idea with investing is you want to trade it in for something else you need, whether it's a car or a house or groceries. Well, when you sell the gold, remember, it's not just a long-term capital gains sale at the current rate of 15%. No. Gold, the U.S. government declares, is a collectible. So you have to pay, I think it's 28 or more percent on any gain that you might have in gold. Now, isn't that clever? Because what we're talking about is gold in relationship to the dollar. Well, shouldn't I get a tax credit if the value of the dollar goes down? Well, let's say that I go buy some gold. Well, I have to pay, I use a lot more dollars to buy the gold. Shouldn't I get a tax credit because the value of the dollar has gone down? Shouldn't I get a tax credit because on the differential there between the dollar value and the gold value? Well, obviously not. Got an email from Jeffrey asking me, Paul, what was that website that you talked about some time ago where you could go in and look at a kind of a random stock chart and then try to look at the patterns on it and predict where the stock would go from there, and then it would give you the answer, right? This was to kind of test your analytic stock picking skills. And I went back in the show notes in the tools section on the website, and it turns out that that was a tool that I talked about, I think, way back on show 52 or something, inspectd.com, like inspected without the E at the end, one of these groovy new web names. Well, I went out to that website, and apparently it's not there anymore. So I guess not as many people used inspected.com as they'd hoped. Also know that Foliodex doesn't seem to be up and working anymore. That was the website that I'd used a lot to calculate those charts, the return versus risk. And yeah, it doesn't. I guess people just aren't interested in money anymore. They're not interested in the stock market anymore because of the, because they got scared out of the market in late 2008, early 2009. But if you're the kind of person that just, can you imagine getting into the workforce in March of 2009 and starting to dump your 401k money in at like March 9th of 2009, you're doing pretty well. I mean, the market has been up big time since March 9th of 2009, and you're feeling pretty good about that. So good luck with that. Todd writes and asks me about, are there any good websites that are have some stock picking games this year? I went out, I think, was it MarketWatch that still has one? I'll have to go back and look. I think it was MarketWatch had a stock. Yeah, the virtual stock exchange, VSE.marketwatch.com. They have a game where you can pick some stocks for the year. You can actually start any time, but you can look at other stock picking games that people have started out there and pick those. I went out to the IFA.com website and I saw that they have a new subsite called ifaradio.com, and guess what? They've got a new podcast that they're doing. It's actually a new radio show that's once a week with the good old hosts Tom Koch and Don McDonald from Sound Investing. And I went and checked, and Sound Investing is still on the air. So I guess Tom Koch and Don McDonald have a new gig with IFA. Congrats to that. I see Mark Hebner appears, and I listened a little bit just now to the first episode where Eugene Fama's son is interviewed from Dimensional Fund Advisors. It should be a pretty good podcast. Recommend that you subscribe to those if you're interested in investing the right way. So 2010 is the year we make contact. You know, that's based on the Arthur C. Clarke book, 2010. What was the subtitle of that book? Oh, it's Odyssey 2, of course. 2001, A Space Odyssey was his first highly successful book made into a highly successful movie. And the sequel, 2010, called Odyssey 2, was made into a movie called 2010. But on the movie posters, it had a subtitle, which is not in the official title of the movie. The subtitle was The Year We Make Contact. And according to Wikipedia, 2010 Odyssey 2 is a best-selling science fiction novel which was published in January 1982. It was nominated for the Hugo Award for Best Novel in 1983. It was adapted for the screen and released as a film in 1984. Clark peppered the novel with the names of various Soviet dissidents, including physicist Andrei Sakharov and Yuri Orlov, human rights activists Mykola Rudenko and Anatoly Marchenko, Russian Orthodox, blah, blah, blah. He says Clark himself makes a reference to getting editor Vasily Varchenko into deep trouble by borrowing the names of various dissidents in 2061, Odyssey 3. Wikipedia goes on to say that unlike 2001, A Space Odyssey, the novel and the screenplay were not written simultaneously. I didn't know that about the 2001 Space Odyssey. And there are significant differences between the two. Well, this is Paul Boyer saying it takes money to make money, and it takes 2010, the year we make contact, to make a mad money machine. I sure appreciate you listening. I hope you go out to the website and take a look at the lazy portfolio analysis, which I'll probably enhance as the days and weeks go on. If you'd like to email me, my email is feedback@madmoneymachine.com. You can listen for my postings at Twitter, twitter.com/madmoneymachine. You can even call me, 571-366-7121, I guess is the number there that gets directly to my voicemail line. I hope you have a happy day.